Maybe I should get rid of this drum. Why, got out of the hospital and I started in chewing gum for some reason or other. And it's so silly, you know.
Well, I think it doesn't really matter very much. Well, you know?
I know it's annoying because every once in a while, why, I get to sort of like a bubble gum popper, you know.
Well, I think it's a...
But it might make your tape sound a little odd.
It doesn't make any difference on the tape. You're not that bad. Yeah.
There's so much that people could do, even today, to improve what nature has laid down here. You remember that with the road that goes out to Chattanooga?
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't too many years ago that was a bog that would take you all day to drive out there. If you look up there near the Pedro Monument, all around there, where this country has been disturbed, you'll see nice trees and good drainage. People living there, but a little ways to there up on the hill, the same little scrubby trees that are maybe 40 or 50 or 75 years older than they were, but as far as any growth has taken place, you'd have to have a very high-powered glass to see any growth.
That makes me think along those lines that maybe as individuals, it's only when we're shaken up that we start to grow.
Well,
you know?
Yes. Yeah, perhaps.
And like if our life was very easy all the time, or we didn't have to, easy not only physically, but emotionally, spiritually, maybe we'd never make any advances.
Well, I think that one of the main things is that spiritually we have not advanced like we should.
Oh, I think
we haven't stayed even as far as that goes.
Yeah.
Because there's a power that must.
Do you think people are afraid of acknowledging that power?
Oh, yeah, sure. First of all, they're afraid of ridicule. They're afraid of not being one of the sheep.
Okay.
And then the few that do, well, they're considered real odd people, you know.
When you were saying people are different now than when you were growing up, when you were first living here?
Believe that here in this country, you had more trust in people. And trust means reliance. It means to trust somebody, you open up more to them. And that is what is needed, because you might have information that is vital to them and vice versa. And there, of course, then you have education. Automatic advancement. But now why you get some book and you have to follow it to the letter, you have to learn it, you're not going to get your degree and all that sort of thing. And its emphasis can be up to the instructor, you know. My God, they could make a communist out of you or most anything out of you.
Well, I think most people's inherent beliefs are in when they're a child. It's pretty hard to really change. That's both good and bad.
Yeah, it's pretty difficult.
It's just a lot.
Yeah. But there's so many things that we just don't know. We haven't got accurate information, and by golly, maybe we're not supposed to, according to a lot of the instructors, because you do the way here it says in the book. Now, maybe the book's 100 years old, but this is it, so it must be the gospel. And it doesn't take too long before you're indoctrinated so that you won't upset the apple cart. And that's what they're afraid of. A lot of people that I know against some of our silly regulations that we have, where we should have free choice. But by golly, you know, they're afraid to say, I'm against this, and fiddle around and wait and let somebody else override their thoughts, and well, it's too late now, you know. So that's real bad.
Yeah, that's what's getting back to old fear again, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it's Jimmy Bedford's writing on Afghanistan. I don't know whether he ever finished the biography or his article that he's doing on the king of Afghanistan. But there's where I became interested in his writings.
I don't know
he's made several trips in there, I guess. And then all at once, evidently a very brilliant man, probably not the best administrator in the world, and he didn't control things quite as well as he should have because communists take over, or tried to. And there's a few that are still fighting for their freedom. And I don't suppose Jimmy could go back there now. Well, maybe he could, but the average person couldn't, you know. A lot of they won't allow a lot of our reporters there. They have to go through Pakistan in order to. Of course, they can't, a lot of them can't even get into Iran. If they did, they wouldn't get out, probably. But I think Jimmy would understand and be able to explain, which I can't do, about how things will go along real fine, you know, and we're like this king of Afghanistan, or whatever, forget his name even, and all at once, why, he's eliminated, and a new regime takes over. Confusion, stability is lost, and that applies to us individually right here. We don't like it, you know, but what can we do about it?
Well, how did you go about making your living years ago here?
That was a funny thing. A lot of people worry about money. And any time you worry about something, why, you're vulnerable, you know, to all kinds of problems. I don't know if we have, unless on special occasions, that we've ever ate as good, laughed, and sang, and played music, and so forth. Quite the way with the emotion that you did when you was young. That seems to be lost.
Do you think that's in part because of a family breakdown or in part because of the technological output of having a TV?
Much of this trash over the multitude of radios that most of them don't even play good music anymore, you know. They're afraid to, I guess. But we learned in the early days about raising gardens. We had one of the first homesteads that was ever taken up and set down here where Wainwright is now.
Oh, that was your home?
There where the... after you pass through the main gate a little ways where our property is, and extended out to where the new road is, and took in an island, and right across the river you could see Bentley Island, what is now Bentley Island, and I'll have to tell you about an experience, quite recent experience about that too, that area. And this island was just like a sponge as far as growing something, you know, and moisture. And they had cultivated wild berries and tame berries and all that. And we had a big cellar. Well, we got a big cellar here, and we keep stuff the year round. You know? And that was always full of everything. And well, we always sold some stuff too. We used to take when I was quite young, we used to take a hitch up a team of horses and load the wagon with vegetables and head out to the mining claims out past Peter, out towards Chattanooga. We'd always sell out before we ever got through to Chattanooga, as I recall. And you meet just hundreds of people, you know. Well, you know, there was thousands of people on the creeks out there mining. Not all mining, but there was.
But what years were that?
Well, ever since I was old enough to, when I was about 6 years old, I think I made the first trip out there. So that was what, 69 years ago. And it was a long, muddy damn trip, you know, with the horses. We always had lots of horses. And we always had other stock. And we had one of the first fur farms ever in the West.
What sort of fur
farm? Oh, we had mink, and we tried raising marten, and we still have one skin from a marten a buck marten that we use for breeding purposes here. Wow. It's in storage right now, but it's still in good shape. And that was, 70 years ago? Over 60 years ago. And we had lots of foxes.
Mm-hmm.
And,
Is that just your parents being sort of entrepreneurs and trying different things?
Well,
you tried anything to make a living?
Dad was always interested in wildlife, and it started when he was about 6 years old catching a ermine back in Trenton, New Jersey.
Oh, my.
It was white. And ermine was supposed to not be white.
Mm-hmm.
And they took it to the trader, fur buyer, and they gave him 5 cents for it because it was white. Well, ermine change colors and are white when they're prime.
Mm-hmm.
So he always remembered that. And we tried raising wild ermine here. They're cute little rascals. Pretty near as cute as a and as fascinating as the marten are, which are just, they're a joy to have around. But they're very difficult to develop as raised. It hasn't been done what I would call successfully.
Not even yet, no.
We could raise them, you know, you could have a wild marten and raise young ones, but always something happened to them. Now that brings up another whole big subject that I better not get into, because I'm in conflict with experts. we had to learn about not only taking care of the stock,
mm-hmm.
But feeding it.
Mm-hmm.
But it was quite a chore. Now, I used to, in the early days, I used to drive stock in from Valdez live into Fairbanks, and then they had a big slaughterhouse here and slaughtered them here.
Why did they drive them from Valdez?
Well, there was no other way. It would take too long to bring them around up the Yukon and up the Tanana and up the Chena.
Oh, not so you could get fresh meat, because there's no other way.
And there was very little raised, you know, and we raised a little. I always had enough for our own use. And there was quite a lot of wild game. There was always lots of rabbits and grouse and ducks and geese and things like that. But that, you're limited in what you can do there, you know. But So they would have regular drives. A cattle boat would come up to Valdez, they unload them, and then they'd drive them in. And when they'd get in here, where they'd be, have a lot of horses that the boys use for riding, some of them good and some of them not too good, and they'd hold an auction, so we'd always take what money that we had, chess kids, and we'd go down, and well, every horse came up for bid, we'd bid $5, and eventually we'd each get one, you know. I think it was sympathy more than anything else, or something that nobody else wanted. So we always had a lot of horses around. We had some good ones, too. And but that was something that it could be done today, you know, I suppose, but it would be probably uneconomical. But that was one way to get in. People to walk back and forth to Valdez, too, you know.
How long a trip would that be?
Well, I don't quite remember. I remember in 1926 being the first one to try to drive to Valdez. I couldn't get to Valdez and had to go to McCarthy. And my brother was, his family was coming in from the States, and he had a job that he had to be on, and he'd been gone for quite a while. Well, he'd been gone since 1922, and so instead of dropping off the boat at Valdez, why, he came into Copper, or up the Copper River Northwestern Railway and to Chittenden, and then I picked him up and we drove back. But it took me 2 days to get to Chittenden. And we took turns driving back, you know, in a hurry. And so I don't recall. It was just kind of a blur.
Yeah,
but, oh, my God, you'd stop, you know, and move rocks out of the road and all that sort of thing.
Well, how did you get enough fuel for a motor car? Did you take all the fuel with you? There
would be caches along the way. Each of the places along the Richardson Highway, Gokana had a little gas, and Copper Center always had seemed to have gas. Copper Center was quite a center, a main center, and you could get a little gas at Paxson Lake and Big Delta, you know, Rapids Roadhouse. That used to be quite a stopping place.
So you just sort of grew up on the land doing all these things?
Oh, yeah. We learned how to buy fur and spent quite a bit of time around all over Alaska buying fur. And my dad bought live fur, live animals for stocking the Alaska Silver Fox and Fur Farming Company in Lake Placid, New York. Oh, that was real early days. And 1939, I was going down the river, and at Crossjacket, I stopped to see if there was any trading, any fur. And the chief there was called Pretty Albert. He wasn't too pretty. Don't put that in print. Because he was all right, but he was called Pretty Albert. I know you. No, I don't know how he would know me. I fool your daddy. I sell him silver fox for $1,000, and he don't know I caught that one day, you know. Well, I didn't argue with him because he felt happy about it. But that was back in 1911 or 12, or somewhere along in there.
He remembered.
Yeah. And he was a young boy at that time, and he eventually became chief of the Crossjacket Indians. Great poker player. I think that's about all he ever done in all his life. I know he didn't do much trapping or anything like that because he let somebody else do that, then he'd, he'd get his share from plain charge.
Yeah.
But pretty over. And but what he didn't know was that that fox, we got $1,500 for it after we'd had it for a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the one that went back to Lake Placid about 1917 or 18 to Joe Sterling, who used to be in Alaska, that owned the Alaska Silver Fox and Fur Farming Company. And he held a big contest there in New York, got everybody kind of like they do around Fairbanks sometime, you know, ever you donate and we'll have a big celebration. So he got a lot of people around New York City to donate this and that for prizes, and then he held a big fox show, wild animals. And what they didn't understand was he had formed an association, and you could register foxes if they come from this Alaska Silver Fox Company. And I still got some pictures of the animal, and one from Joe Sterling in my junk that I got, showing that this animal was the one that took the $2,500 first prize as the best animal in the show, New York City. All he had to do was say, well, I'll bring this from Lake Placid, I'll bring it to New York, and everybody will make money in this free show. And they bought it, you know. I mean, they, we had some pretty good characters here. But the general public don't mind that. I remember Joe Sterling used to send us an invitation to come and spend a week in their home down in Florida, you know.
Yeah.
He never sent any money along with it to make the trip, but it was kind of like, well, you damn dummies up there. But he didn't have any more fun than we did up here.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we always kind of got a kick out of it.
You always thought as if you had sort of a...
Oh, yeah. Well, we were kind of fortunate. We had a very close family. And
did you have many brothers and sisters?
I had three brothers. One is still alive, the youngest brother. And he's out in the hills doing the assessment work on some claims that we have. And he's his game guide for many years. And he used to be a champion dog musher here at one time. And
any sisters?
And he also got rid of the dogs and went to flying. And he's 74 now, still active.
You're younger than you are, then.
Huh?
You're younger than you are.
He And then I had two other brothers, Ronnie and Robin, that Teach had her dad, was the oldest boy, and I had two sisters. The oldest one was, her husband was a U.S. Marshal, Fort Yukon for many years, and Circle for many years, and Fairbanks. And the other sister was a telephone operator here in Fairbanks for many, many years, you know, and, one operator. And she came out and she saw a place there in, near Sacramento in fall of 1921. And she finally ended up down in the Los Angeles area.
Mm-hmm. And did you ever have any desire to leave? Like, did you always feel that this was just the right
place? Oh, I've tried so many places. I haven't been all over the world. Uh-huh. Betty has. She's been, you know, all pretty well. The Far East and Europe and so forth. But I've had a funny little thing happen. I was down there in southeastern Ohio, mm-hmm. at a conference at the university there, and there was a...
But when was that?
Oh, about 70, I guess. 69 or 70. 70, might have been 71, I can't forget.
Okay.
But anyway, I met a chap who is a Negro, dark, from near where Leakley.
Oh, yes, Nigeria, or was it
on? No,
Kenya?
It was the little, good heavens, just changed hands recently.
They changed so many names.
Right near, right on the seacoast, mm-hmm. and he was acting Secretary of Agriculture, and was also Interior Secretary, and he was attending this conference. And for some reason or other, you look at each other, and first thing you know, you're talking. Very well educated, and so we ended up having lunch and talking various times, and ended up by him inviting me and Betty to visit them at his place there at the capital of I can put in here say the name of it, I should have a map handy, but anyway, mm-hmm. I couldn't get the birth certificate, which I would have to have in order to make the trip.
You've never had during the war they hadn't issued?
We had no reason for having a birth certificate until that particular time.
Oh.
We had a family Bible, you know, it had been twice as big as that when it was a big old fashioned one. It had historical data going way back in it, and it's still in the family. And when I retired for Social Security, he said, well, this is the best record we've ever had, you know. And they took a copy of it, and that was it. State wouldn't do that. Now, here again is why I'm not too hot about regulations and some of these things. I was elected to the board, one of two elected members for this retirement board. State Retirement Board.
Mm-hmm.